Friday explaining integrability and planar ADS-CFT and how to use integrability to extract the spectrum of planar ADS-CFT. So let me first review what we did last time in case there is any question. So I started by explaining that there was a connection between renormalizing our bare operators to get renormalized operator and the anomalous dimensions of n equals 4. In particular, once you pick some bare operators and you compute the mixing matrix, you see how to renormalize them, how do they mix in order to get finite correlation functions. The operator H, which renders finite correlation functions, yields also the spectrum of anomalous dimensions, namely the eigenvalues of this operator are the anomalous dimension and the eigenvectors are the operators with a good dimension. And this operator can be computed order by order in perturbation theory. So we considered first operators which were made out of the SO6 scalars. So we have some scalars with some wave function. And we understood that we could map it to a spin chain problem. We think of this trace as being some spin chain with some wave function. And then the Hamiltonian can, of course, act on spin chains, giving me some other spin chain. And I must diagonalize this Hamiltonian, find its spectrum to compute the anomalous dimensions. So in the SO6, the computation we did, it shows that the Hamiltonian could be written in terms of identity, permutation, and this trace operator. When restricted to operators of the form Z and X, where they were complex scalars, it was simply of this form, identity minus permutator. And due to the planar nature of the problem, once I expand in perturbation theory, the range of perturbation theory is also the range of the... The order of perturbation theory is the range of the Hamiltonian that I am considering, that I go further and further in my spin chain. So we have some operators, some states. There are some magnons here, this spin down, which move in the spin chain. And then I said that the scattering of these magnons factorizes. This is an integrable theory. I put some magnons, and their scattering factorizes. And because of the scattering factorization, which I recall followed from the existence of
about the range increasing in perturbation, does expanding in the coupling also renormalize the first term, or is that the one loop leaves that alone, or that's left alone in the higher order terms just at new?
It also touches the first term, okay. Yeah. So indeed, so when I do perturbation theory, I will also have some graphs, say like this, right? So it will also affect the nearest neighbor interaction. Actually, today I will write what the two-loop is, what the two-loop result is. The scattering of magnon factorizes this because, as I said, there exists some higher charges Q3, and therefore I could write completely the spectrum in terms of some Bt equations, whose meaning is the following. I pick one particle with momenta J, and I carry it around the ring, and this is what this picture means. I pick the particle here, I carry it around the ring, scattering with all other particles, and I get the same point. The phase acquired by scattering with each particle plus the free phase must be trivial. And this is what is encoded, for example, in this equation. The phase must be a multiple of 2 pi n, and this is the free propagation plus the phase shift when meeting each of the other magnets. Or, in this product form, I have e to the ip, which are parameterized in terms of this u variable, which was quite useful because Bt equations became just polynomial equations, was equal to some scattering phase, which in terms of this use become just this rational combination. And the energy was given by summing sine square of p over 2, which was also given by some rational function. Any question about this side of the board? No? So then I wanted to consider a toy model where I wanted to consider a different model unrelated a priori with n equals 4 supernormal, which is the problem of trying to put this model, this XXX spin chain, at finite temperature. So when we consider this toy model, it was important to write some energy and some entropy. And to write out some entropy, we needed to understand how the states organize in the complex plane. So our analysis in the limit when L goes to infinity led us to the conclusion that the beta roots, these U's, which parameterize my states, could be either real or complex. But the complex solutions, they were very particular. They were strings of roots separated by I with some given size. For example, here it's a 4-string. And the interpretation of this 4-string, for example, is that of a magnon, say it's like this one, where I have 4 spins down, which moves with some momenta p. But there is some
some magnet, they move localized closely, bound together. And we have these strings. In terms of these strings, now I could understand well how to write an entropy, because now I understand how the states organize in a complex plane. So first we wrote the bit equations in the continuous limit. There was some density of particles and some density of holes, which I recall was related to these mode numbers here. Either the mode numbers were occupied and we were speaking of particles, or the mode numbers were empty and we were speaking of holes. And in terms of these particles and holes, bit equations took this integral form. I have some density in the continuum limit, and I have some kernel, some interaction between strings of size n and strings of size m. The entropy, I will build as usual, the free energy. I have some energy. Of course, here there is all there is some over n. I have some energy, the energy carried by each type of string. And then I have an entropy, which is related to the way I can distribute these mode numbers. And this was an entropy. And then the minimization of this free energy subject to bit equations led to this integral equation here. So it's an equation for this quantity yn, which was this ratio of rho bar over rho of these densities, and takes this following form. I have log of rho n. There is a kernel, so the string of size n interacts with all other strings, and there is a dispersion relation source term. I should solve this equation and plug it into this expression for the free energy, just an integral of energy times this, if you want, renormalized density. Instead of density, I have this Boltzmann weight, if you want, log of 1 plus 1 over yn. So I must solve this integral equation, plug it here, and then I can start taking derivatives with respect to beta of the result, etc., to compute any physical quantity that I might want. And there was a final mathematical trick, which was, instead of treating this equation with all these kernels which interact, I took the Laplacian. I took this discrete Laplacian combination in product form here, where this plus and minus means shift by I over 2. And as I explained, this turns out that this Laplacian localizes the kernels. When I apply it here, all these kernels, they become delta functions. It localizes, and therefore I get this set of functional equations. I have these shifts here. And here it only interacts with n plus 1 and n minus 1. And there is simply a source term. And this I represented graphically in this picture. I have some states with n equal 1, 2. They interact only with the neighbors. And it goes on to infinity. And this is the SU2 spin chain Y system. OK, so any question about any of this? So just then a few comments related to what we've seen. So for example, I did not give any example before, but for example, there is a nice operator, which is called Konishi, which is just trace of phi I square, sum over I. Let me write phi I square as phi I. And you can immediately see that the anomalous dimension of this operator, it's what? When I act now on the SO6 Hamiltonian, notice that if I act with identity or with permutation, I get zero, because identity does nothing, permutation also does nothing, because they are the same. And therefore, because of this minus sign, here I get nothing. When I act with a trace, whenever I act on phi 1, phi 1, I generate Konishi again. So I generate Konishi again 6 times. So I get 6 times. And then there is the one, so when it acts here. But then it can also act here, because so I get 12. G square, 12 G square. So this is the anomalous dimension of Konishi when I act on the trace on these two and on the other two. Another nice operator is trace of Z comma X square. Now I wrote it in the SU2 language. I can now pick the Hamiltonian already in SU2, identity and permutator. And if you compute this anomalous dimension, it's also 12 G square. And it is no surprise, because this, again, it's also Konishi. It's also in the Konishi multiplets. But I just wanted to present these two nice alternative ways to write Konishi. Finally, also another comment about the fact that we are working with traces. We are working with traces, so this is an important restriction on the types of states which I consider. I should consider states which are cyclic invariant. So what do I mean? So in the XXX spin chain,
of course, momenta, the total momenta, times L is equal to what? It's equal to an integer, because I can shift all my system and come back to the same position. This must be an integer. And I can see it trivially, for example, by summing this equation. This is antisymmetric, so this part drops out. Here I get total momenta, and there I get a sum of integers, which is an integer. So, but I don't need to do any computation. This is obvious, right? I pick my system, I shift it back to the origin. Of course, I get an integer. Whereas in n equals 4, the total momenta must be equal to an integer. Not the total momenta times L. It's a further restriction, because I must consider states which are cyclic invariants. So this imposes that I must choose my sum of mode numbers nj to be equal to L times an integer. So this is a restriction on the type of mode numbers that I can choose. And finally, a last comment about these states here, say with four particles here. They can be thought of as another particle, but now it's some different quantum numbers, right? Now it has four spins, so it is not a particle with spin 1/2. It's now a particle with higher spin. So there is a notion that this state can be seen as this representation, whereas this one can be seen as this representation. So I'm just, it's a symmetric four in this case, with four boxes. Okay, so finally, I also mentioned last time in the very end that the Y systems also have a nice form for other models. I can consider other models other than the SU2 spin chain, and the Y systems, I can also draw some Y systems for these models. For example, for the SUN chain, what we get, I told, is the following. I have nodes 1 up to n minus 1. There are some contacts like that one, and then they propagate to the right. So if I solve this Y system, whereby this Y system, I mean that here I have Yn, Yn plus 1, and then it interacts now with these three neighbors, etc., I can study the thermodynamics of an SUN spin chain. So I'm not giving the proof, I'm just telling what the result is. By the way, for the SUN spin chain, the Hamiltonians, which are integrable, would be some sum. I can put some coupling G square, which is irrelevant, of course. And then I have, again, the identity minus the permutator. Of course, the identity is not relevant for us. Of course, it's an overall constant. But again, for SUN, the Hamiltonian is again written in terms of the permutation. It's the only invariant tensor of SUN. So both for SU2 and for SUN, the Hamiltonian takes the same form. Of course, here the Hilbert space is bigger. Also, and finally, before we move on to what I wanted to speak today, let me also write what is the Y system for the Hubbard model. The Hubbard model is an important model in condensed matter. It describes electrons in it describes the electrons with spin moving in the metal. So for the Hubbard model, I might need some more space. So what is the Hubbard model? I don't know if this is known. So the Hubbard model, it's a model where I can have some electrons, I have some lattice. And then I can have some electrons which can be some spin up or they can be some spin down. And in a site, I can also have two electrons, one of them spin up, one of them spin down. And it's a theory where the electrons are hopping in this lattice. So what will be the Hamiltonian? Well, the Hamiltonian, there will be some term here, and then which will give the strength of the hopping of electrons. So I sum over sides of the lattice. I sum over the spin of the electron, which can be up or down. And then I have a term which moves my electron. So it destroys an electron at site I and creates at site I plus 1. So this is the hopping term. It moves in one direction or the other. And it moves either if it has spin up or if it has spin down. And then there is a repulsion if the two electrons are on the same side. Sum over I, Ci dagger up, Ci, this measures whether Ci up, times Ci down dagger, Ci down. So this is a repulsion if the two electrons are in the same side. If U is positive, they don't want to be in the same side, and they repel one another. So for this Hubbard model, if I solve this Hubbard model, it's again an integrable model in one dimension. It can be solved, and the Y system takes the following form. It goes to infinity. It goes to infinity. This is the Y system for the Hubbard model. And I will come back to this Y system in a minute to explain to this one and that one to explain why it is natural, why these Y systems could emerge from group theory, from a group theory perspective. So I will leave some space here. Okay, so today I will come to the Hubbard model again for a few times, so I will not use that word. So let me say what I will do today. So we saw already some Y systems. I just finished explaining that Y systems appear very naturally when studying quantum spin chains at finite temperature. They basically govern the functional equations which minimize the free energy. And I will explain now a deeper connection between Y systems and group theory. Why these Y systems indeed encode the some group theory which is behind, for example, SUN, SU2, or the symmetry group, the underlying symmetry of the Hubbard model. So this is a toy system too. It's a toy model for Y systems. It's related to characters. Then I will mention something which I did not have time last time, which is why the XXX chain was integrable. Where is this Q3 which ensured that the magnons were the scattering factorized? And to explain how the Q3 appears, I will introduce the notion of algebraic bit and sats, and we will start seeing transfer matrices, which is a crucial object in quantum integrability. We will start seeing them emerge. And then I will start my generalizations. I will first move to one loop, but for the full theory, for the full n equals 4, for the full 2,2/4. Then I will move to higher orders inside the SU2 sector, and then to higher orders for the full theory. And these last two points will be asymptotic in a sense that I will explain. Okay, so first about characters. So a character, let me recall, in some representation lambda of a given group element G is the trace over the representation lambda of the group element G in this representation. So I take my group element, I change representation, I take the trace in the corresponding representation. A representation lambda, I can indicate the representation by the corresponding Young tableau. And I have in mind super Young tableaus in case I'm considering super Lie algebras. But for those who are not used to super Lie algebras, just think of usual Lie algebras. And then, so we have these representations. And now I want to understand where is the space where the Young tableaus live. So where do these Young tableaus live, say, for SUN algebras? And the answer is the following. For SUN, we cannot symmetrize more than n boxes, right? So we have, when we symmetrize n boxes, it's again a singlet. So for SUN, these fat hooks, they live in these characters, they live in the, let's call it the fat strip, which is, I have some lattice. Here it's 0, here it's n, and they live inside this lattice. So, for example, a possible Young tableau will be this one, for example. If it was a bit bigger, it would be trivial. And this is a possible representation, one possible Young tableau. So here, the representations are trivial. OK? I should also say that for supergroups, say for SUN/K, this is like a supergroup. It's the one which appeared in N equals 4 super Young Mills. I have 2,2/4. It's quite similar to SU4/4. The vectors, they have bosonic and fermionic components. And therefore, when I symmetrize or anti-symmetrize, it's easy to see that there is no natural bound on what I can symmetrize and anti-symmetrize. More precisely, I mean, there is some bound, but the way to state it correctly is as follows. The Young tableaus now live in a so-called fat hook of size k by n. So here and here I can have some Young tableau. Like this. And again, on the boundaries of this fat hook, the representation is trivial. Furthermore, and this will be the representation most, which are turn out to be most important in all this business, let us consider rectangular representations, which are parametrized by, where lambda is parametrized by AS. And by this, I mean something like this one here, where my Young tableau is some rectangle with A symmetrized boxes and with A rows and S columns. And then I can ask myself, okay, so representations, higher representations, I can build them from fundamental representations. How does this fusion of representation is encoded into these characters? How to see that the higher characters can be built in terms of the smaller characters? How to relate all these representations? For example, I recall that the character in the fundamentals, I recall this identity, which probably is familiar to many of you. If I have, for example, the symmetric plus the anti-symmetric representation, I can write them, the sum of them in terms of the fundamental one square. And the answer about fusion, so the fusion of representation, can be encoded into the following nice relation, which is the character in representation A and S square is equal to the character in representation. There is, it's a bilinear relation. Which tells me that, which reads as follows. So I have this bilinear relation between character in representation AS and the character with similar representation, but where A or S are shifted by plus and minus one. And this relation, so notice it's a relation on A and S, this relation lives in the fat hook, right? So this relation, A and S, they take values inside this fat hook. Or this fat strip in this case. So this would be S, and this would be A. Okay. Next, and this is the final thing. Now I will make contact with the Y systems. And this, I can call it Hirota, or mini Hirota, because as we will see tomorrow, that it's a slightly simpler version of Hirota. This is called Hirota equation. And the Y system equation is obtained in the following form. I define some quantity, small y, as, which I define as chi a s plus 1, chi a s minus 1 over chi a plus 1 s, chi a minus 1 s. Then this quantity, it obeys the Y system equation, y a s square is equal to 1 plus y a s plus 1, 1 plus y a s minus 1 over 1 plus 1 over y . So it's a relation where I have y square and y interacts with the horizontal neighbors and with the vertical neighbors. And it follows from Hirota. And it's a trivial consequence of Hirota. And notice, where does these y's live? These y's, notice that there is shifts here by a plus 1 and a minus 1. So these y's, they do not live on the boundary, because on the boundary they would be related to some representation here, which is 0. So the y's, they live in the bulk of these fat hooks. So the y's, they obey some functional relation, which is the functional relation They obtain the relation I wrote, and the y's, this is where the y's live. They live in the bulk of the strip. And these y's, they are a toy model version of the equation we found above. The only difference is that above we have these shifts by plus and minus, which are shifts in the spectral parameter, and here there is no spectral parameter. Here we only have the index a and s. So if I write the y system for this model, for example, I get exactly the same relation, instead of this square, I get ya plus times ya minus. Okay? So you can think that this y system here, it's like the quantum version, the quantization of these relations. So, and indeed now we understand that each node here, I can give it a precise group theoretical interpretation. Each node corresponds to a particular representation. And if you track down, if you see which bound state is each node corresponding in the original derivation, right, because it came from bound state, you can see that indeed it is a state which transforms precisely in the representation as indicated here, in the same way that these states here were in the symmetric ones. And let me comment something, that these guys here, they are more fundamental than the y's, right? Of course, these characters, they are more fundamental than these derived quantities y. So this seems to be telling us something about these y systems, whether there could exist some set of more function or more fundamental quantities. Okay. So this is what I wanted to say about y systems for today. And I will come back to this tomorrow. And now I want to move about to my second point. I want to consider the algebraic Wittenzons. Any questions that you might have, please ask. Yeah. Yes. All these rectangular representations are the ones which appear here. Algebraic Wittenzons will explain us why this model is integrable and where is Q3. Yeah, okay, let me try. So for this one, it's very likely that I will do mistakes. But the weights are basically the difference or the rules. I don't remember exactly. I think the difference is probably.
The orthogonal basis is just the sum of
Normally, I don't know how to refer to this place.
Is rectangular just like row 0, 0, 0, 0, 0? Is that the.
Well, it wasn't in what basis, but so in the orthogonal basis would be N1. So, what is it? So
the usual weight basis, I'm thinking.
The Dinkin weights here, for example, are 1, 1, 2, 2, 2, 6, I think. These are the Dinkin weights in this diagram. Just a number of. Is this satisfactory? I don't know much about weights. Maybe it's wrong.
So it's regular, the guys where you get 0, 0, 0 in the Cartan basis. You get 0 everywhere except one. One guy and then the two, which is S.
0 and 9, except one guy would be a rectangular one.
It's like the symmetry tensor product of A, S time, right? That you write.
Yes.
So that's
okay. Okay, yes, indeed.
This is the power of.
Okay. So let me move to the construction of the algebraic Wittenzons. How to understand why some Hamiltonians are integrable? How to build integrable Hamiltonians?
So at the beginning, so I have here one page which is slightly abstract, so we will have to, you will have to believe me that this will lead to integrable ML problems. So we will start with some definitions. We will define an operator which is called, which is R of U, and which is called R operator, which is just U minus I over 2 plus the permutation operator. And this operator I will represent it in this way. I just represent it as a cross. So it's an operator which acts, of course, on a tensor product of two spaces into a tensor product of two spaces, of two equal spaces.
What do you mean by a cross?
But a cross, I mean, it's the definition of the picture. This operator, I mean this picture. So it acts on two vector spaces. So I have one vector space V here, another vector space V here, and it gives me two vector spaces here and here. So it's like the index here of this operator, which I did not represent, like it's the matrix. Right, so R, it's R, A, B, C, D. And here are the indices. Okay, so this is the first definition. Then I'll define a monodromy matrix L, which is R0 L, R0 1 view, which graphically is represented by this. I have 1 up to L. Sorry, let me put L here and 1 here. And then I have a vector space 0, an auxiliary space. And I multiply R's in this way. So the index 0 is multiplied and it's left free at the two extremities. And this, and all the quantum indices are open here. This is another definition. So this is R operator. This is monodromy. Monodromy. And then I have the transfer matrix T of U, which is the trace over this space 0 of this L of U. So graphically, it's an object which graphically I already drew it several times. Okay, so these are just a couple of definitions. Any question about this definition? So this object here, it's a quantum object. It acts on this tensor product of L copies of V into the tensor product of L copies of V. Right, which is the full quantum space. And now, with this definition, we can have a couple of facts. And the fact number one is the following. I can build my XXXML domain in terms of these objects. So this is a fact, and it might seem a bit, you might ask, why do I want to do it? And this will become clear in fact two. But the fact one is that T, this Hamiltonian, is roughly speaking proportional to this t minus 1 of 0 times t prime of 0. This is what I mean by the log derivative of t. So this is fact number 1. If I take the derivative at 0 multiplied by t minus 1, I get, roughly speaking, the Hamiltonian. So let me explain first why this fact is true. When I construct t of 0, no, sorry, 0 is I over 2, sorry. I shifted here by I over 2. When I consider t at I over 2, what happens t at I over 2? Well, at I over 2, my r becomes just a permutation. And so when I pick here in my t and I put just permutations, I get the following. I get that each r becomes just a permutator. And therefore, you see what this is. This picks each state, and it just shifts it to the neighbor. So this is just the shift operator. Right? Next, let's consider t prime of I over 2. What's t prime of I over 2? Well, I take the derivative, and I put I over 2. So in all terms except one of them, I keep the permutation. So I sum over k. And I always use the permutator, except at point k, where I use the identity. And then I continue again using the permutator. Right?
because I act with a derivative on one term, so I'm missing one permutation, which is just the identity. And therefore, when I construct t minus 1 of I over 2 times t prime of I over 2, what happens is the following. I shift everyone to the right except one position, and then I apply t minus 1, which shifts everyone to the left. So at the end, I did almost nothing except talk to the number k, which because I didn't shift amounts to, at the end to a permutation. So I get sum k equal 1 of 12, just permutation of k and k equal 1. Just finally, the net effect of shifting almost everything to the right and then back to the left is just that the guy at number k was shifted. And this, of course, is our Hamiltonian. It's almost our Hamiltonian up to a constant, which was this identity, which I don't care. So fact one is checked. So, okay, now the fact two is why, concerns why is this relevant. Well, the fact two says that R of u obeys Young-Baxter relation. It obeys this relation, whereby these vertices, I mean something like R of u minus v. I have some u's and v's. So if I write this object acting on three spaces, I can check that this R of u obeys this Young-Baxter relation. So R of u for us is a completely mathematical object. Recall that I told that S matrices in integrable models obey this relation. But this R for us, it's not an S matrix. It's just an auxiliary mathematical object which allows us to construct Hamiltonians. This one looks something like R 1, 2 of u minus v, R 2, 3 of u, R 1, 3 of v is equal to the sum in inverse order. Right, this one, then this one, then this one. Then the third fact concerns the existence of higher charges. And so let me explain how do I find these higher charges. And the point is the following. If I construct now this object here, then by using Young-Baxter several times, I can relate this object with this. This is just by Young-Baxter. I use Young-Baxter to shift each one of those lines to the other side. And what this relation means, mathematically, is that L of u times L of v times R of u minus v is equal to R of u minus v, L of v, L of u. And this in turn implies, when I take the trace, it implies that the commutator of t and u with t and v is equal to 0. When I take the trace, I multiply by r minus 1, then I take the trace, the r disappears, and I get the trace over two spaces, which is the product of the traces. It's a tensor product, and therefore I get this object t's commute. Right? Because I have two auxiliary spaces, O1 and O2. So when I make the trace over O1 times O2, I get this relation on the transfer matrices. So these objects T, which are just objects which act on V to the L to V to the L, now the auxiliary spaces disappear, these objects commute. But in particular, since the Hamiltonian is just the log derivative of this T, this implies that the Hamiltonian commutes with this object T of V, which depends on V. And since it depends on V, I can expand it. So here I have Q3, Q4, etc. So here are the conserved charges, and therefore the model is integrable. So here is integrability. Okay. So the algebraic bit ends up. So here I explain why the model is integrable, where are these higher charges, and these higher charges come because the Hamiltonian commutes with this T of V for any V. So this commuting relation is the
It's very non-trivial, and it means that there exists many non-trivial conserved charges. Okay. Now, the algebraic bit on that is the method which allows us to solve the following diagonalization problem. I pick T, a view, and I want to diagonalize T of U. I act on a space, and I get some eigenvalue. Lambda nu tangent space. So it's quite a general problem. If I solve this problem, notice that I solved in particular the problem for the Hamiltonian. Because if I solve this for any U, then the Hamiltonian is just a log derivative at some particular point I over 2. So this is much more general than the problem we want to solve. And the algebraic bit on that allows us to solve. And the solution, so if anyone wants the details of how the algebraic bit on that goes, how it diagonalizes these operators, exploiting Young bugs, et cetera, I might give at the end. But the solution is the following. Lambda of U is given by phi. I will explain what I will tell what phi is in a minute. Of U plus I over 2. Q, I will also explain, of U minus I, Q of U plus the complex conjugate. Phi of U minus I over 2, Q of U plus I over Q of U. Where this phi of U is simply the function U to the L, and this Q of U is a polynomial which encodes the position U minus uj when j equals 1 up to m. It's some given polynomial with some sets of zeros, and I will now explain that these zeros are precisely the Magnan rapidities. So for a given set of zeros here, I'm studying a state with a given, it corresponds to a state with a given number of Magnans. So first of all, notice that this operator here, a priori, so this lambda, does not seem to be polynomial because it has this 1 over Q here. But it must be polynomial because it's the diagonalization of a product of U plus I. So lambda of U, if I impose that it is polynomial, it implies that at U equal to UJ, the residue must cancel. So it implies that phi of UJ plus I over 2 over phi of uj minus I over 2 is equal to minus q of uj plus I over q of uj minus I. And this is precisely the Bittan-Zatz equation. These are precisely a way to write those Bittan-Zatz equations. If you see, this product there is precisely what the Baxter polynomial automatically does for me. And the I's over 2's and the I's are precisely as I wrote in the Bitt equations. The spectrum of the Hamiltonian of the XXX spin chain, for example. How do I compute it now? Well, if I know lambda of U, I should take log of lambda of U. I should take its derivative at I over 2. This, as I told, gives the spectrum of the XXX spin chain. So what happens when I take the derivative at I over 2? Notice that at I over 2, this term here vanishes. Because I put here I over 2, I get 0 to the L. Right, so this term vanishes, and I don't need to consider it. This term here gives a constant L when I take the log derivative of this term. And this one here, if I take the log derivative at I over 2, it's easy to see that it gives 1 over u squared plus 1 quarter. This one here is precisely the energy as I announced. And this constant L, which comes from this term, is simply because here I didn't get the constant right. I got only the permutation, I didn't get the identity. So if I do it carefully, I get so I get this extra constant here. So this is just a way to compute the spectrum of the series. So finally, let me make just one comment, which is the following. This problem, as this algebraic Bittan-Zatz technique, is much more general than just the spectrum of the XXX spin chain. For example, I could have chosen, instead of taking one derivative of log, I could have chosen to take two derivatives of log of transfer matrix. and I would immediately have obtained, again, the spectrum. I would just take two derivatives. When I take two derivatives here, it would mean that I would be considering a longer-range Hamiltonian. Now there will be two terms which will not be zero. And it's easy to see that if I consider this combination here, when I take n derivatives, I effectively gain an Hamiltonian where the range is n. Unfortunately, it is not the Hamiltonian of n equals 4 super Young Mills. The Hamiltonian is not obtained by having some transformations and taking higher derivatives of it. And I will explain this a bit later. Okay. Any question about this algebraic Python sets?
So the fact that u has to be polynomial,
yeah,
because R of u is.
Exactly, because R of u is a polynomial, so I'm diagonalizing a polynomial operator.
And also, the fact that when you say you take high derivatives of p, then you get something that's, say, longer range, but I don't quite see why, say, it has to be faster than the two.
That's because of the log. So, yeah, that one has to do carefully, but that's true. But it's not obvious, is it? Yeah?
You can think about this as a connection.
Yes, so this monodromy matrix here, I can think of it as an operator which transports me around this. So indeed, this object here, often, when the continuum limit exists, these objects often are mapped to the path order exponential carrying something to the other. So these are the quantum versions of the usual Wilson transport of flat connections. And this U here plays the role of spectral parameter in the flat connections. So they are indeed the quantum analogs of that stuff, of classical integrability. Okay, so now I'm ready to go to the third point. So Bittens are situations, so at one loop, I mean nearest neighbors, for general super Lie algebras. And how to write the Bittens as for a general super Lie algebra. So let's consider first SO6, where here I have some Dynkin diagram. So when I want to specify SO6, when I want to tell what I'm studying, I should tell you what is the Dynkin diagram, and this tells you what is the group, and I should tell what's the representation. And this representation, as we were talking, I can put some weight here, some weight 1, for example, here, which corresponds to the vector representation. So this would be the Hamiltonian which I considered there, the Hamiltonian where I have the SO6 with the 1 there. So this means that the weights, as you were saying, here are just 0, 1, and 0. And there is a Cartan matrix, which is just the usual 2 minus 1. OK, I have some weights, and I have some Cartan matrix. And then the Bittens-Zatz equation, they encode both the weights and the transformations, and they can be written in a very concise form in the following way. I have phi, now here I might not have space, so the Bittens-Zatz equations, they are phi, sorry. So for the Bittens-Zatz equations, now instead of just uj, now I will have uj1, uj2, and uj3. Now the spin waves, they are parameterized by 3 repetitivities, because basically the rank here is 3. I have 3 SU2s, and to parameterize my spin waves, I need U1, I need 3 species of repetitivities, U1, U2, and U3. And then the bit equations are as follows. I have phi of UJ comma A, so A runs from 1, 2, and 3 in this case, plus I over 2 times VA, this Dynkin weights, over the polynomial phi of u j comma a minus I over 2 VA. So this is the analog of u plus I over 2 over u minus I over 2 to the L. This phi is u to the L. So this is just the usual. And here I have product over B. B also runs from 1 to 3. of the Baxter polynomial of type B, which is obvious what it is. So Baxter polynomial of type B is product where J goes through one up to the number of roots which I choose of type B, U minus UJ of type B. I have Q of type B of UJ, A plus I over 2. And here the interaction is encoded by the Cartan matrix over the same thing with minus. Okay, so this is the final result. Given a certain Lie algebra, a certain representation, I can immediately write down the nearest neighbors Bitanzatz equations in this form. Any question? So you can see that for SU2, I just have one node with a 1. And if I want to consider XXXX with spin, so this is the usual XXX with spin 1/2, XXX with spin S, for example. It's also an interesting model. Here I put the weight to S, for example. Okay, so the erasers are there. So now we can write immediately then, what are the bit equations? What is the spectrum of n equals 4 to one loop? Yes.
Do you have sort of like same extinction model for that?
For this one, the Hamiltonian, for example, it's precisely the Hamiltonian of the SO6 of Minahan and Zarembo, for example, the one we saw there. So this is what is the Bitanzatz for the integrable nearest neighbors Hamiltonians. So in this case, as I told, it's the one which I am erasing here. I didn't erase it yet. It's for this one, for example. So it's diagonalizing this operator.
Can I ask more basic questions?
Okay, well, let me, maybe I will keep it here in this. Yes.
In the simplest case, you find the form of the solution, the equation is satisfied. How do you actually find the actual root? How do you compute?
Mm-hmm. How do I find this if it is this?
Oh, given that they have to satisfy this relation, how do you compute them?
This is a set of polynomial equations. Mm-hmm. Right? So I just solved this polynomial equation. So they are, how many? I have, so here I have k1 of these guys, k2 of these guys, and k3. So I have k1 plus k2 plus k3 polynomial equations. Right. So here the index j a is one of those k1 plus k2 plus k3. Right. So I have to solve this entangled k1 plus k2 plus k3 polynomial equation. So in practice, either I am in some continuum limit where I can trade this by some densities, or I have to use a computer. Or the number of particles is not so big, it's like 2 or 3, and then I can try to play with the polynomial. Good. Okay, so then about n equals 4, super young Mills at one load. Well, there the group is PSU2,2/4, and the representation is the field strength representation, which is the set of all these derivatives, psi, x, etc. Just the usual representation inherited from the Lagrangian. So let me write you what is the Cartan matrix and the weights for this model, and you can immediately write down bit equations. So now it's a super group. So there is a super Dinkin diagram, also called Kack Dinkin diagram. So it has 7 nodes. The rank is 7. You can think of this group, this is roughly speaking SU8. So if you don't want to think about detail, there are some nodes which are fermionic because there are some fermionic roots, but these again are details. There is a representation, the field strength is a 1 here in the middle. And this diagram, it also encodes the Cartan matrix. And when I have a fermion, I put a 0. And then the usual, when I have a boson, I put a 2. When I have a fermion, I put a 0. I also change the signs, -1, then a boson, then a fermion, then a boson, and then a fermion.
So, okay, so I give you this M, this set of bit roots, you can immediately write down 7-bit equations for n equals 4 trinomials.
So was it derived actually, or?
Yeah, so this was derived, yeah. So at one loop, everything was perfectly there. People computed the Hamiltonian, diagonalized, and found this bit equation. This was done by Beiser and Stoddart. So Beiser found the Hamiltonian, and then Beiser and Stoddart wrote these equations.
So what is the Hamiltonian?
Okay, I will write it in a second. This is why I didn't erase these two, because I want to write the third one and keep these ones for comparison, but let me...
Can you write on the R matrix?
I can, yeah. So I will also mention that. I will not write it, but I will mention. So let me just tell that I should solve these equations, and then I compute the energy, which is sum up to K4 of G square U J of type 4 square plus 1/4. So the root number 4, so here is U1, U2, and U4 play the special role. It's the one which carry momenta. It's the one, those are the ones who give me the spectrum. This is sum of 4 g squared sine square of pj over 2. The other ones, they just encode the polarizations of the magnets. But the magnets themselves, I can think of them as this one. So this is how I compute the energy. I solve these bit equations, and then I plug them into this expression to compute the energy. I might explain in a moment what's the physics behind this nested bit and zats, but in a while. Now I want to explain just these Hamiltonians. So I'm running out of time. In SO6, so what are the Hamiltonians in the interval? What are these Hamiltonians? So in SO6, I have an Hamiltonian which interacts two neighboring sites, and they are in representation. They are in the vector representation. I have 6 times 6, and this gives me a trace. It gives me an anti-symmetric, and it gives me a symmetric traceless. Anti and symmetric traceless. And indeed, what are the invariant tensors of SO6? They are, of course, the projectors into each of these representations. By definition, this is an invariant tensor. I rotate my states, and they keep in the irreducible multiple. So, and indeed, this Hamiltonian. This is basically, I have some number times the projector into the anti-symmetric plus some number into the projector into the one. It happens that the anti-symmetric, no, that into the anti-symmetric, and then some projector into the traceless. Identity minus permutator projects into the 15, and this trace projects into the traceless part. In the same way, for SU2, I also have two spins, one half plus one half, and this gives me spin 1 and spin 0. And again, this is some number times the projector into the spin 0 components of the tensor product of one half with one half. So I can understand immediately what the Hamiltonian for n equals 4 will be. So in n equals 4, when I make a tensor product of two field strength, because now the representation is non-compact, I will get here an infinite sum up to 1, up to infinity of all the representations of 2, 2/4. So now I decompose it to an infinite set of multiples, not only a finite one. This is like SL2 representations. And the Hamiltonian, and I refer, if you want to see more details, you can see Nicholas Beiser's thesis. This explains these points in detail. And then the Hamiltonian of PSU2, 2/4 is given by some G squared. And then there is some coefficient, which are some harmonic numbers, and then the projector into this multiplet PJ. So this, and this H of J is defined as sum up to J of 1 over K, some harmonic numbers. So this is an elegant way. I write here the Hamiltonian of 2, 2/4. And as was mentioned, let me just mention that there exists an R matrix, R of U, of PSU 2, 2/4, directed such RF matrix, which yields this Hamiltonian by the usual algebraic Pitons axis. I take the derivative at some point, and this R matrix is a sum, again, of projectors, and instead of this H, I will have some ratios of some gamma function.
A sum.
So whenever I have an object which acts on two sides, it must be a linear combination of the projectors. These are the only invariant tensors. Mm-hmm. So this R matrix here is a sum over the projector for J, and then there are some gamma functions. Mm-hmm. U plus J or gamma U minus J, something like this.
So what is this P? I mean,
it's the projector, so when I fuse two representations of 2 × 2 + 4?
All bicycle ones,
the irreducible ones.
All the reducing representations?
Of 2 × 2 + 4, yeah. They are non-compact and I generate all the non-compact. But let me not go into these details of representation theory because it's really...
And it's known to be integral, yes.
And this simultaneous is known to be integral precisely because there exists an R matrix, I told.
And that's known, was known before? It was
and that was known before. This was even known before. I mean, to some extent.
Like the higher spin is U2 or matrix.
This can be thought of, I mean, when I restrict myself, notice that this is 2.254, this is bigger.
Yeah.
But if I restrict myself to SU2 or to SL2 sectors, it indeed corresponds to the higher spins. Okay. So this is all I wanted to speak about one loop. So in this way, we understand, we solve this equation, we can compute the spectrum of all operators of n equals 4 to one loop. So, as Amit said, it looks complicated because it's a set of polynomial equations with 7 types of roots and polynomial, but we should keep in mind that this replaces the computation of Feynman diagrams, of all Feynman diagrams at one loop, of all possible operators, so it's still a huge simplification. It's very explicit, if you want. So now, we want to move to higher loops. And let's consider first just SU2, the SU2 sector, where we have the usual, where we have the equations at one loop. And we want to understand what does this go to? UK, UJ minus UK. What does it go to when once we start increasing the order of perturbation theory? And the energy was given by sum over 1 over u squared plus 1 squared. Okay. So the Hamiltonian can be computed for SU2. And the result is the following. I have 2g squared. Sum of identity minus permutator, this one we saw yesterday. And then there is the g^4 1, and the g^4 1 also has sum over number size. And then this one is of the following form. I have minus 8 the identity plus 12 the permutator. So as you said, it mixes with this one, it changes the coefficient of this one. And then there is minus 2, and I mean here, permutes I and I plus 1, and then there's an anti-commutator, I plus 1, I plus 1, I plus 1. And this one, of course, this is equal, graphically, this plus this. And here the range is already. And then if I consider, if I continue, I get g^6 times something like, which will take me one line, plus g^8 times something which will take me probably one page, plus it. So it starts to be more and more complicated and not very inspiring. If you look at this Hamiltonian, it doesn't teach you much.
So it was computed up to 4 loops?
Up to 4 loops, this was computed. The result is the following. Okay. So first of all, how would I try to compute the spectrum using the same techniques which I computed before? In the first lecture, which is the coordinate with ansatz, when I try to write an ansatz and try to find the spectrum. Now, the ansatz would be some wave function, psi of n and m, which would be equal to some incoming wave some S matrix, some outgoing wave. But now, if I take this G to the 4 order, what I should include is I should include some term A when they are closed. Now there is an interaction which is slightly non-local. It, the range increased a bit, so I should prepare a wave, receive a wave, but when they are very close, I might introduce some extra fudge factor. This would be the natural ansatz. And this will describe me what's happening when they are interacting. All the complications, I might hope that they could be encoded in just a contact term like this. And if I consider higher order in perturbation, I will also have some term here when n is n plus 2, etc. I need to start putting these fudge factors in order to correct me my ansatz. And then I might hope that in this perturbative sense, notice that this all I will always be thinking perturbatively. In this perturbative sense, I might expect integrability.
Do they all come from the same R matrix?
No. This is what I mean. It's perturbative integrability. So the Hamiltonian it is not in the usual sense, it is not something like a second derivative of some log of some t. It is not. If it was, it would be a commutator.
They don't commute at different orders, like G4.
They don't commute. So you cannot find the exact spectrum for finite G. You can find that leading order and always think perturbatively by including extra such factors and working in the coordinate with ansatz. There is no algebraic formula, not some non-perturbative algebraic formula, which solves this model. So this model, if I write it like this, with G finite, is not integrable.
It's not integrable. But no. Are you saying that if I look just at G4 term, it is integrable?
No, it is also not integrable. Even the G to the 4 is not integrable. So this Hamiltonian at finite G is not integrable.
Yes.
This Hamiltonian is integrable in the sense that I start with some wave function, then I put plus G squared. This S matrix is also S naught plus G squared S1. And when I'm solving this ansatz, I always keep terms up to G squared.
So is the energy still the sum of some...
So not everything is locked. It's not perturbative in the stronger sense for finite G, but it's integrable in the perturbative sense, and the energy is still given by some of, by a sum of individual energies. So I will write now what is the correction to the energy and to the big equation.
Are these corrections, can I think of them as being some unitary transformation?
No,
there is no understanding of...
There is no algebraic understanding of the... of these corrections. And I mean, there is some, but I will explain what it is. But not in this language of 2.2/4.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Even in the SU2 subsector, you're saying?
Even in the SU2 subsector, there is some understanding of the algebraic structures when I will change my language, the language which I'm working on. Soon I will no longer speak about Hamiltonians, and you will see what I will speak about instead. Okay. We started like 10 minutes later, right?
20 more minutes.
Only 20, but we started a bit later, no?
Okay.
Yeah, okay. So the result... up to three loops is the following. The big equations, they become, instead of those ones, they become the following. X plus J over X minus J to the L. This is what replaces the left-hand side. This will be E to the I momenta J. Will be equal to exactly the same expression. Uj minus uk plus I. Uj minus uk minus I. Product over k not equal to j. I will tell what x plus x minus is in a minute. The energy is given by the sum up to m magnets of 2ig over x plus minus 2ig over x minus. And what are these x plus and x minus? They are a deformation of this u. So x of u plus 1 over x of u is defined to be u over g. So this is the definition of x. There are two solutions. Let's take the one which is outside the unit circle of this quadratic equation. And x plus minus is defined as x of u plus minus I over 2. So you see that for g much smaller than 1, x is approximately equal to u over g, and this equation becomes precisely the one-loop equations, right? This ratio becomes u plus I over 2 over u minus I over 2, and here if I compute this combination, I get precisely u squared plus one squared, right? So I reproduce the one-loop results. Otherwise, these are the equations which turn out to solve this to higher orders.
So this is true in up to three loops.
Up to three loops.
Higher orders is not all.
No, it is not all orders. Now I'm.
So it means that this equation comes from the same type of Baxter phi q plus
I can encode these equations if I want in terms of some Baxter polynomials and transformations, yes. But they will be made by n. They will not have some algebraic origin. If I want, I can write some I can write some t of u such that regularity of t of u implies this equation. But this t of u will not have an algebraic origin. It will be just some polynomial which I will write by hand.
But it cannot be ultra-localized as a
No. It is not known to be the diagonalization of anything reasonable. Mm-hmm. Okay. So this is up to three loops. And now, more than three loops, the conjecture. So at first, when people started computing, they thought, okay, if this folds up to three loops, then it's very natural that these are the exact equations. But more than three loops, I have a factor here, a sigma, which is called the dressing factor of uj and uk. This was conjectured the form by Beisertid and Staudacker, that equals some DES as index. And this factor, very surprisingly, it's 1, and it starts precisely at 8 loops to be non-trivial. And this is why this factor was only discovered much later than the proposed deep equations, because it's one of those cases that you would compute in perturbation theory, and only at 4 loops it would appear. So only very recently, only a couple of years ago it was understood. And this factor here, I will say a couple of more words about it, but it is now its form is completely conjectural. I should say something else. This energy here, when written in terms of momenta, is the sum of this famous generalization of BMN formula. So it's almost a relativistic dispersion relation. It's a square root. You see that when g is small, it expands, and I get just 4g squared, as I should. Actually, not 4, because there's some factor 1.
This is the conjecture formula. Or
this is an exact formula.
For energy, okay. But with momenta to be found from this basic equation.
From momenta to be found from this basic equation, yeah. So this is the energy. I sum these dispersion relations. And, of course, we should keep in mind that how did I find this? I find this by writing such ansatz, where I have some such factors. But I always assume the chain to be large enough so that I can act with Hamiltonian on these plane waves to read off the energy. So there is some regions where the interactions are not important. Like in the XXX spin chain when I solved, I showed that the free propagation gave me the energy. So there was a region where I could read off the energy. So this is asymptotic. So this result is correct. And there are, at order g to the 2L, there are corrections which this ansatz does not take into account. So this is what it means. It's all order result, it's exact, provided the operator is big. So for a big operator, I can go to a higher order in perturbation theory. This order of perturbation theory is where I will start having some diagrams when I consider my perturbation theory. So suppose I'm considering some diagrams. And then at some point, I have interactions which completely wrap my operator. So this is the famous wrapping effects. So finally, let me make just a comment. Let me just make a comment back.
So I'm going to show about this. Is there an example where it was computed for? How do you know that it exists? you expect it on general grounds? Or?
So in general, you expect it. It was computed at for loops, and it was computed at for loops. This was computed explicitly at for loops. By the way, perturbation theory.
The signal is precisely due to the wrapping effect.
No. It is not due to wrapping effect. No. I mean, at 10, it is there also if you consider state with size 100. But if you want to consider order of perturbation theory 10, you need to take this scattering into account. The easiest way to see that it's needed is if you want to understand what this equation should describe, for example, at strong coupling. Mm-hmm. At strong coupling, you know that this equation should encode the motion of strings in S3 because of the idea of CFT duality. And there it was known what to expect for this function. It was something non-trivial. So it ought, at some point, it should decouple from one and start moving into the good direction. Okay, but and I will give some other arguments about, I will tell what this function is in a minute. So let me just tell something. Let's consider this Hubbard model again. And let's take U to be very large. And then when U is very large, I get a model where the electrons don't like to be at the same position. So I get an effective Hamiltonian acting on a spin chain. And this Hamiltonian will be given by some g squared times the nearest neighbor plus a g4 times the next nearest neighbor plus a g6 times something plus etc. Just because when I have this repulsion to be very strong, this g will be basically t over u, and I can have electrons which hop and then hop back, and but they don't like to hop a lot because of this repulsion. So I can think of this as an effective Hamiltonian where I'm integrating out the electrons and I keep only the spin degrees of freedom. And the range of perturbation theory is describing this process where I have an electron, it hopped there and then it came back and it might exchange the spin. And you get an effective Hamiltonian for this spin chain. And this effective Hamiltonian, I can consider Magnan scattering, and it turns out that it corresponds precisely to this. The effective equations correspond precisely, and the Hamiltonian corresponds precisely to n equals 4 super young Mills if this phase was 1. This is something quite remarkable. So, this effective Hamiltonian, all these split equations which come here, are precisely the ones which follow from the Hubbard model if this factor here was 1. So at some point, people believe that maybe the Hubbard model is the fundamental description of this model. Notice that for the Hubbard model, there exists an R matrix. This objective is local, and there exists an R matrix, which is a local R matrix, and you can compute the spectrum exactly. And then this long range comes because of this effective treatment. And in the Hubbard model, the wrapping interactions are perfectly taken into account. They are just the electron which hops and goes around the circle. So if such description exists for n equals 4 super young Mills, it would be an exact algebraic description of 2,2/4. And such thing was never understood if it could be corrected in order to incorporate correctly n equals 4. So, but it's a promising direction.
For A, B. So what would happen to them?
No, what would happen is that the wave function would be naturally written in terms of this electron and spin degrees of freedom. And once I would start out describing them solely in terms of the spins, I would have indeed such description. This wave function would be correct. Just that here, the nature of this effective description would be more complicated, of course, than this fundamental one. And this extra complication, this long range, would be something fictitious. But I could always work with a more fundamental law. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So.
So we did this.
This Hubbard, this correspondence to the Hubbard model, this one was understood by Adam Ray, Matthias Staudacher, and Divina Serban. By a group. So, yeah, you are right. You should ask me for references. I'm always forgetting to. So it was understood, it is easy to understand from this discussion, that this Hamiltonian description might be a bit inadequate, in the sense that you see that the results start being highly complicated. It's already occupying here one page online. And the final results, they are really simple. So this leads to the proposal that we, at the end of the day, we only want the S matrix. And then we write immediately bit equations. So this leads to the idea. Let's try to trade the knowledge of this PSU 2.2/4. And let's replace it indeed by a language. Let's change this language and let's discuss instead the S matrix of magnons. And let's try to skip the Hamiltonian and work directly with the S matrix.
When you say S matrix, it will incorporate the sigma factor.
It will incorporate the sigma factor. Let's see, let's try to work with this S matrix. So this here would be the S matrix. Okay.
So you the conjecture that it will be factorized even when you take into account the sigma form.
Yes, yes. The sigma is also the form. You see, it's also sigma of uj uk. It's also factorized. Okay, so this leads me to the last point though, which I wanted to discuss today. Now I will move to all sorts of operators in 2.2/4 to all loops. This will be possible. This change in language from Hamiltonian to S matrix will be very fruitful and will allow me to immediately find the all order equations in this asymptotic notion, in this asymptotic sense, that I need a spin chain to be big, otherwise I don't have enough space to have this notion of S matrix, etc. So this S matrix stuff. So now I will, as I told, think I have some trace, some fields. They can give to get the picture. I think of a long operator, and here I have some magnets. And these Zs are my vacuum. Let me make a parenthesis and say that via the ADS CFT duality, what this feature corresponds is to a string where I have some excitations on the worldsheet. So this is a huge jump, but in Lipkin gauged string theory, I have this big string with some excitations, and the size of the string is J. And I have here one up to J fields. Let me just open a parenthesis inside the parenthesis to say, to recall you about static gauge in flat space. The energy is just given by the string tension times the integral d tau of t, d sigma. So if t is equal to tau, if I choose a gauge where I parameterize my target space time to be the same as the world shape time, then notice that sigma should range from 0 up to energy over square root lambda. So the range of sigma is in some good parameterization related to the energy of the string, which makes sense. A very big string has a big energy because the tension times the energy. So here it's the same. I fix some light cone gauge. The size of the string is related to the angular momentum in this case. Okay. So what is, how, now the object, as I said, I change from Hamiltonian to the S matrix, which will have some index A, B scattering to C, D. And now I want to understand this index. I want to understand what is the symmetry under which S transforms. So notice that it is not 2.2/4. It is now I am considering that I want to consider the subgroup of 2.2/4, which rotates the magnon among themselves and kills the vacuum. So it should be the symmetry which transforms an X into a psi or into a Y field, or into a derivative. It's the symmetry which rotates the magnons among themselves, and it's the symmetry which kills the vacuum. Right? It's the residual symmetry once I fix some vacuum. And so this symmetry is SU
2/2, if I consider what's a subgroup, extended, there is some extension, squared. So it's a subgroup. It's like, imagine you have SU8 and you have SU4 times SU4 subgroup. And this is the symmetry under which the S matrix transforms. So S matrix, there are particles, and the particles transform into SU2/2 squared. So Magnon is equal to, it's some particle with some momenta P, and then it has one SU2/2 left and one SU2/2 right. So this is what a magnon is. Why extended? Why this extension? And this makes it very non-trivial, this model. Because recall that the symmetry of n=4 super young mu, or even of any reasonable gauge theory, when we say that the symmetry is 2,2/4, we are oversimplifying a bit, because what the symmetry is 2,2/4 entangled with gauge transformations, with a direct product of gauge transformations. And if we analyze this carefully, what these gauge transformations do, by gauge transformations I mean the following. When we have a supersymmetry transformation acting on a fermion, it often gives me terms which are of the form commutator of two scalars, right? And these terms I can interpret as gauge transformations in the following sense. If I pick the commutator of two supersymmetries and act on some field, I get something like g² commutator of z with the field. So it's like a gauge transformation where the parameter of my gauge transformation is a field of n=4. A more complicated gauge transformation, but it is a gauge transformation. Okay, so we have, instead of 0, so normally it would be 0 with no extension. Normally I mean no extension. When we take into, so okay, this is the symmetry group, and why does it help me? Well, it helped me because now I can try to impose that the S matrix is invariant under this symmetry. I take my S matrix and I impose that it commutes with the symmetry generators of 2,2/4. And what comes out of this analysis, this was done by Bizard, if I write my S matrix, is the following. The bosonic, if I impose that it commutes with the bosonic symmetry generators, this is the same as to say that I should put the indices properly. I should not do stupid things and put the indices in a ridiculous way. When I impose that it commutes with a fermionic generator, it gives me constraints on the coefficients before each of the terms. And what turns out is that this fixes completely the S matrix. No. Sorry. Here, that now it's a matrix, right? And what I'm telling you is that if you impose that the S matrix commutes with the bosonic generator, it just means that you put stuff which is reasonable with this index, like delta ABs, epsilon ABs, and reasonable stuff. Then you impose that it, and this automatically ensures that it commutes with the bosonic generator. This is by definition. Then you impose that it commutes with the fermionic generators, and it gives extra constraints on the coefficients behind each of the invariant tensors that you will write. And this fixes completely the matrix part. Up to a function. And this function is what is the dressing phase. So if we impose that it commutes No, that's quite remarkable. Here it is. Good point. So let me explain that. So this argument is based solely on symmetry, and only symmetry fixes the matrix part completely, which is quite remarkable. Normally it is never the case. Normally you have to further impose Young-Baxter equation. But here what happens is more powerful. Only symmetry allows to fix completely the matrix part. So let me just write this before I answer your question. So the S matrix is given by some unknown function. Now it is just a function, P and P prime. And then there is an S, a matrix part, left times the same. Let's not put the index, it's obvious. And this is the 2/2. So it decomposes the 2/2. Where did we use that it's a planar limit?
We never use the fixed plane.
So that is true even in a bound plane?
No, because we use the notion, of chain and excitation scattering in the chain. So if it's not integral, nothing with the, everything I'm speaking loses sense.
No, I mean when you impose Q and S equals 0.
Yes. So this, you know, if you want, there's. In the discussion itself, in the fact that I say I have some fluctuations which move here and they scatter and they move in the spin chain.
Also, you assume, well, you said you didn't assume the probability here, you got it.
Ah, this is what I'm going to say now.
Mm-hmm.
I have this S matrix which fits completely. Mm-hmm. And what does it mean? It means that whenever I will have a system with 2.2/4 extended symmetry, this will be the S matrix. So now I must cross my fingers and say either it obeys Young-Baxter and the model might be integrable, or it does not obey Young-Baxter and there are no integrable models with 2.2/4. No, it turns out that S obeys Young-Baxter. So we are happy. So
you plug for any sigma or
for any sigma. Sigma is an overall function. When I put it in Young-Baxter, it factorizes. Only the Young-Baxter only can.
Okay. It's always integrable. Okay.
So it could be integrable. It could also be that the three-body S matrix doesn't factorize. But that would be strange. But it's integrable at this point.
Well, everything is not used so far. Well, it's used then.
It's implicit in the fact that I am discussing single spin chains.
But you used only Q, comma, S equals 0. You never used that explainer or not. You used only the symmetries. Or only the single trace if you're ready.
Yes, but if you want all the symmetries, I'm already thinking. I mean, there are some subtleties when I
No, but the symmetry doesn't imply that S a three-body factorizes.
No, it does not.
So that's just that S two-body satisfies Young-Baxter.
S two-body satisfies Young-Baxter.
That doesn't mean that.
And S three-body factorizes, and this is something that you have to check, and this turns out to be.
But that the fact that it factorizes doesn't follow from.
The fact that it factorizes doesn't follow from anything I said. I can try also to constrain an S matrix of 3x3, and I find that in general symmetry alone does not allow me to see that it's a product of two S matrices of 2/2. So
the fact that it factorizes a conjecture, then, or it's an additional input.
To show that it factorizes, you can either compute perturbatively and you check that it factorizes,
yeah, given all the
or you can argue that you have conserved charges, and therefore factorizability will follow automatically. And the existence of these higher charges,
yes.
This one I can deduce, say, from if I believe in ADS-CFT, I can clearly see what these charges come from the string point of view, and it's reasonable to assume that they are preserved at the quantum level, and therefore there is. It's much easier to explain why there are many charges than to explain why the scattering factorizes. But we saw that they should be equal. So it's easy to argue that this theory admits many conserved charges.
But strictly speaking, you would need to establish.
Strictly speaking, I would need to establish that it factorizes.
Yeah.
And this is believed. If you want that assumption, it was checked at strong and at weak coupling to a few orders, but it's very reasonable to assume so. No, because of this existence of these higher charges, it also implies that the number of particles is conserved. This is something typical of integrable models. There is no particle creation or annihilation.
I understand that. So I'm just saying, in the present case, that's the SU2/2 strong enough to train, that there's no.
Ah, sorry. I think it is, but I'm not completely sure. But I think it is. Okay. Good. So, what about? Let me then. What is known about this sigma? So, as I explained before. So, once we have this S matrix, I will be able to write down BP equations. I didn't explain yet how, because now these are matrices. But I will explain it in a minute. Actually. Do I have some more 10 minutes?
Sure. We are not hungry.
I am not.
We are not.
Okay, so you should impose a cutoff on me. Yes. So let me tell what this sigma BES is. So I'll give you now the expression which is valid to all orders. It was conjectured by Weissach, Tiedemann-Stahl-Dacher. It passed quite a lot of non-trivial checks. And its form was proposed first in terms of the higher charges of the theory, this Q3, Q4, etc. And after many papers of simplification, there is an integral representation by Torrey, Hoffman, and Malvasina, which is the one which I'm going to read right now. So this S matrix, this sigma, is given by the following form. So to write it, I should introduce an extra function chi, and it's given by a combination of this chi plus plus, where, for example, chi plus minus, I mean chi of x plus with y minus. X plus and y minus parameterize the moment, as I explained somewhere. And then what is this function of two variables? It's the only thing I need to explain. Chi of x and y, a function of two variables, is given by the integral over the, there is an integral representation over the unit circle. It's a double integral of z1 and z2 over the unit circle. And then there is a log of a gamma function, 1 plus ig, z1 plus 1 over z1, minus z2 minus 1 over z2, over z1 minus x, z2 minus y. So if you think it's not so complicated, it could be much worse. So it's a double integral. And then there is just log of gamma function, g. The coupling only enters here. So here is g on this point, and it's given by this integral representation. So,
can you give the idea where you get this?
So,
because you say that integrability doesn't enter the game.
Integrability doesn't enter.
So, what's the extra ingredient to get?
Yeah, so the extra ingredient to. So let's try to see how would we do it in a normal integrable field theory, relativistic. We will do as follows. First, we will do symmetry plus Young-Baxter to constrain the matrix part. This we did already. We didn't even need to use Young-Baxter. And then we have this extra factor. So normally, this extra factor, sigma BEF, should be fixed by what? It should be fixed first by crossing symmetry. Mm-hmm. Well, here the theory is not relativistic. This dispersion relation is not exactly relativistic. But still, you can generalize what you mean by crossing symmetry, in the sense that it relates particles in different channels, the scattering in different channels. The notion of channels also exists. And you can write a crossing equation. This was done by Yannick, who generalized crossing symmetry of integrable models to this model, and who managed to write an integral functional equation that sigma VES must obey. Still, once you write this crossing equation, normally you have many solutions. So it is still not good enough to constrain sigma BES completely. If you want, this is the simplest solution to this crossing relation. What checks can we do once we have this simple solution? We can check that it contains the good double poles in this case. This is based on this analysis of poles which Landau did. Landau was able to identify a general field theory where should the S matrix have some double poles. The double poles are associated to some physical processes. And this was checked that it obeys, it was checked by the same people who wrote this Dory, Hoffman, and Malvasina, who wrote this integral representation. Then it was checked that this S matrix works up to g to the 8. So this reproduced perturbation theory. And it works at strong coupling. At strong coupling also, it reproduces the expected string results. And there are by now a few all order checks of this chi. As I will explain tomorrow, related, you can ask me again what I mean by this, to Lusher correction. So it turns out that to compute the leading order correction to Beek equation, there is a formula in which goes by the name of Lusher correction, and there the S matrix enters to all order, so it was probed already to all order. There are quite a few convincing checks, but it's of course conjectures. So I wouldn't like to end today without writing down big equations. So how to write down big equations once we now have complete this matrix? Well, as usual, we should pick a particle, carry it around the ring, and impose periodicity. So what we should do is we should pick one particle, carry it around the ring, and impose that the wave function is the same when I have e to the I pjl times this. So what do I mean? Let's again make this algebraic. Let's make these figures. By this I mean e to the I pjl times a product up to m of k of now an s, which is a matrix of pj with pk times psi should be equal to the same psi. So I have a diagonalization problem which I need to solve. So this is the diagonalization problem. I need to solve it to compute the spectrum of my momentum. Okay? Now, notice that this problem, we will use now the same techniques. It's a particular case.
Just again, so you have this X matrix which is by your Baxter, but then if you take the logarithmic derivative of the transfer matrix coming from that, you still don't get the Hamiltonian to start.
Exactly. So here, this X matrix obeys Young Baxter. I will now construct the transfer matrix. So let's construct the transfer matrix. But the physical meaning of transfer matrix here is completely different because now this S matrix is something physical. It's not like an R operator which gives me Hamiltonians. Here, what the S matrix, what I should do with the transfer matrix is something completely different. I will tell what I should do with the transfer matrix. So now I construct, as you said, transfer matrices. We saw that they are natural objects, and we can often diagonalize them by algebraic Vitanzats. So let me construct the transfer matrix, which will be the trace of some auxiliary space of the S matrix, the matrix part. So let's call this transfer matrix left, because I will consider the left one, of P with T1 times the S matrix of some P with some PM. So this is this picture that I have in mind. I have my particle 1 up to M with momenta P1 up to PM, and then I have a ghost particle, a ghost virtual particle with momenta P which goes around. So I construct this object, TLF, and now I want to see how to relate it to the problem which I want to solve, how to relate it to the diagonalization problem. So I will exploit exactly the same type of techniques that we use to understand the XXX spin chain.
So when you say S matrix PP1, before you did not put any argument to S matrix, but it was...
Yes, yes, here it's all it. Yeah. So now I use the following fact. As before, recall that R of I over 2 was just permutator. Here, the S matrix of 2 equal P, it's also just a permutator. This is something one can see from the explicit form, which I never wrote. So the S matrix at particular point is equal. And this means that the transfer matrix left at a particular point PJ, what happens when I put P to be equal to one of these momenta? What happens is that one of these transfer matrices becomes a permutator. So in this picture, one of these S matrices becomes a permutator. So what I get is precisely, I have this, and then at the point J, I get a permutator, and the virtual particle exchanges quantum numbers with a ghost particle. And this picture is precisely what I wanted. Here, this is precisely what I want. So So what we want to solve then is, we want to solve the problem where we have e to the I p j product of this dressing factor, I should treat it separately, p with pj, times a left transfer matrix of p times a right transfer matrix of p acting on psi is equal to psi. If I can solve this problem, right, then I can put p equal to pj and I find the solution to my original problem. Right? So I should find, so our goal is to find what is the eigenvalue, say of t left acting on psi, which is equal to some lambda left of u acting on psi. And when I compute these lambdas, I just need to plug them here and obtain the spectrum. So notice that here what we do with the eigenvalue is completely different. Before, we had the eigenvalue and we will take the log derivative at some particular point to obtain the spectrum. Now we will compute the eigenvalue, put p equal to pj or u equal to uj, and equate this combination to 1 to find the quantization of the momentum. But technically it's very similar. I should just diagonalize this t and then work with the eigenvalue. Okay? So I will write what is the result for this eigenvalue now. And from this result of this diagonalization, from the result of this eigenvalue, we can immediately find all the equations. So, I wanted to have written this before we started, but I didn't have time. So, lambda left is given by the following. It's also parameterized in terms of Baxter polynomials. So recall that we will now have u1, u2, u3, then we have u4, and this is what I'm describing now, one of the SU2 slashes. As I told, there is this picture here, and these two slash twos, I didn't say, but the 2/2 are basically this one and this one. These are the two SU2 slash twos. Oh, they are in the linking diagram. And this transfer matrix will depend on three types of auxiliary roots, because I'm diagonalizing a problem with 2/2 symmetry. So the spin waves now have 2/2 symmetry, so they are parameterized as in SO6 by the rank of this guy is 3, so by three types of beta roots. And I have the usual polynomials, qa, which is product of u minus ua, and I also introduce a polynomial, r plus minus, which is product of x minus xa minus plus, and the polynomial d, which is product of x minus 1 over x minus plus. So you see, that this is like a deformation of the one-loop polynomial. At weak coupling, this is basically q, and this is basically 1 at weak coupling. Not 1, but it's a trivial factor. The ratio of this is 1, and the ratio of r is the ratio of this. And then this lambda, it becomes simply written, and I use the same notation as before. F plus plus, for example, is f of u plus I. Shifts by plus and minus means shift by I over 2. And now I can write what the transfer matrix is. I've already done the last part. So the transfer matrix is then given by q3 plus over q3 minus plus, it's a sum of foreign terms, q2 minus minus, q3 minus, r plus minus, q2, q3 plus. R, it's always R and B are always for the roots of type 4. Okay, so this is the result for this lambda view. And now I can tell you what are the Beiser-Stahlhaber equations. What are the equations which give the whole loop spectra of n equals 4 supreme nils? So there are 7 equations. Seven, recall, it's the rank of PSU 2,2/4. And in this language of S matrix, we understand 7 as 3 plus 3 plus 1. So what do I mean by this? I mean the following. I have the equations describing the spin waves of the left 2/2. I have the spin waves describing the waves of the right 2/2. And I have the scattering of the magnets themselves. So where are these 7 equations? Well, when I have this transfer matrix, again, I should impose that the transfer matrix is regular. And these poles, which seem to be here, must cancel. So when I cancel the poles in Q3 between this and this, I get one equation for the U3s. When I cancel the poles here, I get the second equation. And when I cancel the poles here, I get the third equation. So this explains 3 of the equations. This is for the left guy. Then I get 3 similarly when I write the eigenvalues of the right SU2/2. And then I get the last equation because once this U1, U2, U3, so this, once U5, U6, U7, once this and this are fixed, I still need the equation for U4, which is obtained by equating these eigenvalues to 1. By putting this here, and equating all this to 1. Right, so this is the condition like lambda e to the IPL is equal to 1, and this is lambda right regular, and this is lambda left regular. So you can now immediately read from the expressions I gave you. You can easily check what is the condition for each of the terms to be regular. You get 7-bit equations, and from these 7-bit equations, we can read off the spectra of n equals 4 from the expression which is here. This is just sum of the square roots. The number of beta roots is the number of roots of type 4, K4. and the equations, you can read them from what I wrote, completely explicitly from what I wrote. So let me end just with some physical picture. And this will be the last thing. So, any questions so far?
Yeah, I have a very technical question. So, How do you define T-lab of Pj? T-lab of Pj.
So this is functions of U, right? This is all functions of U, if you want.
T-lab.
It's defined here. T-lab.
T-lab. The eigenvalue is this lambda, which is a function of U.
I don't understand how you define.
T-left is defined here.
T-left is defined here.
That is function of n.
So it's function of p1 up to pn, and also of a p, which is here.
That's right. And there, in the middle board.
And here, I change this p by u.
I thought on that board. Your T-lax is function of only single
momentum, isn't it? Okay. When I write, so T left is a function of P, and then it depends also on all the momenta Pj, on U1, okay. U2, and U3. But for the discussion, it was only important to stress out the dependence of P. But it, of course, you see from this expression, it depends on U1s, U2s, U3s, and also on R's and B's, which include the position of moment, Pj.
And
yeah.
So what do you mean by T hat? So T there is...
I put hat because it should be T hat, everyone.
I see, so T hat, you read as
T hat because it's an operator, and lambda is in the eigenvalue.
Which is some...
Which is this?
Huh?
Okay, so I wrote completely the... So from here, we can compute the anomalous dimensions of any operators. Let me just, for example, relating to the beginning of what I said today. For example, if you want to consider Konishi operator, for example, this would correspond to putting K4 equal to. I have two magnets and no other polarizations excited, and I will put them into the bit equation which I described and compute the spectrum up to four loops. If I want to consider an operator of the form z to the j, x to the m, and then d covariant derivatives, plus permutation, for example, I should put k4 equal m plus s, and then k3 equal k5 equal s. So these quantum numbers I just read from the Dynkin weights. So this is another example. You put these occupation numbers into the bit equation, you solve, and you get the spectrum of these kind of operators. And this, of course, it's valid up to these wrapping orders, where the interactions start interacting with themselves. So this is asymptotic. So just so what is this nested bit and sats? Physically, what can we have in mind? We have some spin chain with some z's and then some magnets. So these are z's. And these are magnets, x, x, then I can have a derivative, then another x, then a fermion, then a y, then an x. Okay, for example, like this, something like this. Yeah. Let's put two fermions here, two fermions and then x's. And then what we did to solve this problem was we split this problem into nested levels. So we first thought of this spin chain as being a spin chain where I have lots of x's and some particles. And I don't care whether these particles are x's. So these are x's or psi's. I don't care whether they are x's or psi's. And in this case, I have 1, 2, 3, okay. So here I have like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I have like five magnets. And then what we do is we go now, we think of the spin waves. So now we have 5 magnets. Now a lattice of 5 magnets. And the magnets, they can have now polarization. So some magnets, I can flip them into fermions. And here I think of 5 magnets in a lattice of size, I don't know how much this is size, but something like 20. And here now I think of this, when I now start thinking of the polarization of this magnet, I interpret this subchain as 2 magnets in a chain of size 5. And indeed, if you look at bit equations and you start seeing the channels, you can clearly see that they are like SU2 nested equations with this interpretation. So what we are basically doing is we have some particle, they scatter, and there is some phase gain when they scatter, when the momenta scatter. But then, even if I disregard my lattice, and if I look only at my particles, the particles themselves also have spin waves, which scatter among themselves. So, and basically this nested bit equation, they are the equations which entangle the scattering of the spin waves, when I consider only the isotopic degrees of freedom, with the scattering in the real physical space when my particles scatter. Okay, so tomorrow I will start by making a short summary of what we did. Then I will move to these wrapping interactions, and then I will explain how to compute the full spectrum of any plus
four. So far it's computed up to terms.
So far it was up to these terms which are of order g to the 2L. So far I need big spin chains. And tomorrow I will explain how to go beyond this limitation and how to compute it exactly. Okay, thank you.